So what I'd like to talk about today, one of my hobbies is that of gardening. And so as I was thinking about this talk today, I was thinking about entitling it Cultivating the Secret Garden. St. Louis Catholic history is like a secret garden. It's too seldom visited and too little appreciated. And it's like that secret garden. It has great trees, blooming bushes, delicate ferns. Think about it, look around. The Archdiocese has one of the most magnificent cathedrals in the Western Hemisphere. Many of our parishes have churches that could be cathedrals in other dioceses. We have schools, a long history of schools, of hospitals, convents, monasteries, and a lot of unsung heroes. And today I'd like to look at that a bit. You know that in the Midwest, many of us are very devoted to our irises, but irises have to be taken care of. Every couple of years, you know, you have to go into a garden fork and divide them back up again. And so that's what I'd like to do today, is to take some of those irises, break them up a little bit, and look at them and come to appreciate them a little bit more. First of all, I'd like to say something about the brief life of Sister Justine Mulhall. Many of us don't know anything about her, but she caught my attention while I was reading about the cholera epidemics here in St. Louis in the 19th century, and particularly the cholera epidemic of 1848-1849. Sister Justine was 18 years old. As a sister of St. Joseph, teaching at the time at St. Vincent de Paul Parish in South St. Louis in the Soulard neighborhood. And the sisters closed that school that fall because of the epidemic. And there were so many people getting sick and so many dying. And instead, the Sisters of St. Joseph opened an infirmary in that school to care for the people of the Soulard area who were dying from this disease. Sister Justine contracted cholera also, she and another sister, Frances Nally. What caught my attention was that as she was dying in that convent, that the Archbishop of St. Louis, Peter Richard Kenrick, came to her and spent days with her as she was dying. And the night that she died, he spent all night by her bedside. That it meant that much to him, of this wonderful devotion of this sister. The Sisters of St. Joseph of Carondelet in that one epidemic lost three sisters that year. The Visitation Nuns lost one. The Sacred Heart Sisters lost two sisters and two novices. That little story reminds us of the thousands, in fact, tens of thousands, of women and men who quietly have given over the centuries their lives to Christ in service to his church, his holy people. Where we sit today, we are surrounded by a host of souls and saints who made possible the church that we have today. 10 years before the death of Sister Justine, I came across another priest. His name was Father Benjamin Pettit. He was a young man from Belgium. He came to America to become a priest, and he was ordained by Bishop Brute in Vincennes, Indiana. Now, one of the Vincennes had, it was a very large diocese, and it included Chicago at the time, and much of Indiana and much of Illinois. The other part of Illinois was part of the Archdiocese of St. Louis. And Father Pettit was invited to ask to become the chaplain for the Potawatomi Indians in Indiana and Illinois. And he was happy to do that. This was a Catholic nation, the Potawatomi. And it turned out that he was away on a visit up to Chicago when the Indiana State Militia showed up, and they rounded up all of the Potawatomi Indians, some 900 of them, and began moving them, forcibly expelling them to Osawatomie, Kansas. This is known in history as the Trail of Death. And Father Pettit found out about this, and he went and found the tribe as they were being moved to the West and joined them. We know a lot about this particular incident because he regularly wrote letters back to his bishop, Bishop Brute, describing the horrors of what these people were going through. They had been promised, all their land was confiscated, but they'd been promised nice land out in Kansas. They were told that when they got out there, which would be November, that there would be cabins already built for them, and that food would be able to see them through the winter. When they arrived in Osawatomie, there was nothing there. There was no town, there were no cabins, there was no food. They were left out in a field, and the state militia then just packed up and went back to Indiana, leaving them basically there to starve. One out of every four Potawatomi died on that trail of death. And Father Pettit buried them all along the way. Every morning before they began, he said mass for them, and then he continued on in the back, in the baggage train, caring for the dying. And as I said, he wrote to his bishop all the time explaining that. He himself became very ill. And so as the rest of the Potawatomi went off to Sugar Creek trying to find some help there, there was a Jesuit settlement there. He and one Potawatomi warrior, a man by the name of Abram Burnett, made their way to St. Louis, where he was seeking medical treatment. Father Pettit was taken in to the Jesuit community at St. Louis University and was cared for. But unfortunately, on February 10th of 1839, this young man in his early 30s died. Before he died, however, he was visited by two individuals, and he had a huge impact on them. One was a nun, Rose Philippine Duchesne. And she wrote about Father Pettit back to France and asked again for permission to go to the Potawatomi, and this time she received the permission to go. The other was a Jesuit priest, Father Peter de Smet, and he was very much inspired by Father Pettit's life also. We know a lot about St. Rose Philippine Duchesne. There's a statue right back there of her. We know about her canonization. She's had several biographies. The mosaic in the cathedral reminds us. We know that she was born of a very wealthy family, and she had a very strong will. At the age of 18, she joined the Vincentians against the wishes of her parents, and she stayed with the Vincentians in Grenoble, in the convent of Saint-Marie-d'Arnaud, until it was closed down by the French Revolution. She was then sent home. And she stayed with her family. Eventually, the family moved to their country estate because it was becoming so dangerous during that revolution. But she didn't stay there. Eventually, Rose Philippine went back to Grenoble and formed together a little society called the Ladies of Charity. And these were lay women who simply went around and took care of elderly and dying and visiting people in prisons. And the French Revolutionary government didn't pay any attention to it. But what they were doing was they were networking, and they were arranging with underground priests so that as these people were dying, the priests were alerted to this, and they were sent for, and they brought viaticum and extreme unction to the dying. And she assisted them in having underground masses and other things of that nature. This was very dangerous stuff because on one occasion, two priests in Grenoble were caught by the government operating as priests. And that afternoon, they had a trial, and that evening, they were both guillotined. Same thing could have happened to Rose Philippine if she'd been found out. She eventually joined the Sacred Heart Sisters and made her way to America. We all know that story. She established the first school for girls in the Midwest, in St. Charles, and then later to St. Ferdinand. She's also the foundress of Maison de Vie City House. And of course, she was known among them for that. 1 year, she was with the Potawatomi for 1 year minus 1 day. And she got the nickname from that, the woman who prays always. That's all she could do is pray, because she'd never learned the language. In fact, she was not very good at languages at all. She didn't speak English very well either. I'll tell you a little side story here. A couple years ago, the Shrine of St. Ferdinand had opened its doors for people to come in and visit. And I came, and one of the sisters there was dressed up like Rose Philippine Duchenne. And some of the others were volunteers, were dressed up as religious of the Sacred Heart also. And they had some little children in there, and they were dressed up like 18th century children. And it was a very nice tour. And as I was finishing the tour with my sister, I began to leave. And I turned to the sister who was playing Rose Philippine Duchenne. And I said to her, sister, your English has improved considerably. And without a blink, she responded back, I have been practicing for over 200 years. So, Rose Philippine, irises grow by sending out shoots, rhizomes, and Rose Philippine was a prolific iris. There's a school named after her. Her sarcophagus is a pilgrimage site in St. Charles. The Shrine of St. Ferdinand, if you haven't been there, you really need to. It's one of the treasures of this diocese. And of course, she has been an inspiration to countless numbers of religious of the Sacred Heart and to the alumnae of the Sacred Heart and many, many others. I'd love to tell you about a couple others, John and Brian Malamphy, and the Sisters of Charity, and how they brought them to St. Louis and founded the first hospital in the Midwest. In fact, if you got sick, the only hospital you could go to would be in Philadelphia or Washington or New York or Boston. There were no hospitals anywhere around, and they established that. I'd love to be able to tell you about Dr. Simon Pollock. He's a famous eye surgeon. He was one of the founders of the science of ophthalmology. His life was saved by the Sisters of Charity during the cholera epidemic. And he later on went on to become a very important doctor during the Civil War and was a champion for the Sisters of Charity and the Sisters of Mercy. Interestingly, he was Jewish. But let me end with one other that is often neglected in the Secret Garden. She has a children's home named after her and also an annual parade. Now, her name is Annie Malone. She was not Catholic, but certainly very Christ-like. She was born in 1869 in Metropolis, Illinois. She was born with no natural advantages. She came from a slave family. Her father had been a slave who later on served in the Union Army. They were very poor. She was black. She was a female, and she was very interested in chemistry. Now, females interested in chemistry in the 19th century didn't have any chance at all. But she used her knowledge of chemistry in cosmetics. And as a result of that, she began in 1902 coming here to St. Louis and selling her cosmetics from door to door. By 1904, she had enough money to actually set up a store. By 1914, Annie Malone was a millionaire. That means that in today's money, she was worth $24 million. Quite incredible. She didn't keep that all for herself. She built a beautiful, magnificent building called Poro College in the DeVille neighborhood in North St. Louis. There, they did manufacturing for the cosmetics. They sold the cosmetics retail. She had classrooms teaching other young ladies about various things. They had an auditorium there that sat 500, and on a regular basis, she had people coming in giving lectures. There was a dormitory set up for girls who were not from St. Louis that would be able to come and study, and she had a chapel there also. By the 1920s, Annie Malone employed over 200 African-American women, each of them making good wages, helping to support their families. She set up a series of franchises of other schools all over the world, all throughout North America, South America, Africa, the Philippines, and enrolled in those schools were over 75,000 women, bringing them hope and encouragement. She had a great philanthropy. She was very charitable to different organizations. She heavily endowed Howard University's School of Medicine in Washington, D.C. She was attacked in courts by her ex-husband, who was very greedy and a disgruntled employee. And finally, she died in 1957. She only had $100,000 left. But she took that money and established then the Annie Malone Children and Family Service Center, which is still there today. Here are just a few St. Louisans whose lives enriched our community and have enriched our church. We've cultivated the secret garden a little bit today. We've explored and examined some of the lives of those who have gone before us. And now that garden is a little less secret, and we appreciate it a little bit more. I'd like to say something about the books also and how that came about. I was asked to consider doing a history of the Archdiocese of St. Louis because it's been a long time since we've had one. Father Faraday did that wonderful Dream by the River series there, but that goes back to the 1970s. And before that, it was Father Rothensteiner who did a magnificent job in 1928. But frankly, nobody reads Father Rothensteiner anymore. It's very difficult reading. And so people asked me if I would do something to make it more contemporary. And so I began working on the project. To fund it, Archbishop Carlson gave me $10,000 with Miriam Press to publish volume one. The idea behind it is this, that the proceeds that came off of the sale of volume one have now paid for volume two, and volume two will pay for volume three, and volume three will pay for volume four, and at the very end, the proceeds from volume four will be returned to the Archdiocese, and it won't cost anybody anything. So, and our hope is then to be able to bring a new look at the history of the Archdiocese of St. Louis. It's a phenomenal history. It is so interesting. We're living right in the middle of it right now, and so it heightens our appreciation. Knowing its history and knowing the people who've gone before us heightens our appreciation for what we have. Thanks be to God. Thank you.